By the power of movie fighting, ring the bell, sucker! This is Movie Fighters, the show where Chris Sims and I, Matt Wilson, we watch movies and beat them up. We are coming off our four-episode run of rapper-slash-actor movies.
What is it called?
Well, since you named it, I'll let you say, Chris.
Okay, I think you're talking about our fan favorite series, rapper slash actor, right back at you.
That's correct. That's what that was. That is complete. And so
done. It's over. It's finished.
But we may come back to it eventually. But now we're dipping into something else. This could be a one off. It could be the start of a series. Kind of depends on what we decide and what you, the fans, want. We thought about calling this March Mattel Madness.
March Mattel Madness. Also, I think another one that I think is good is if it's only this movie, He March, I think is good.
He March is also good because we're watching the live action Masters of the Universe movie from 1987.
Also From Here to Eternia.
From Here to Eternia would be good if we were like mixing it with some old movies or something.
We could watch From Here to Eternity next week, next episode. That would be a real change of pace.
That would be the weirdest episode of Movie Fighters yet, by far. We're watching Gary Goddard's Masters of the Universe movie, produced by Globus and Golan, the producers you also know from Superman 4 and a ton of other not very good movies of the 1980s.
Some of the great movies, I think, is what you mean. We're talking about the studio that brought you Ninja 3, The Domination.
I mean, they also produced Bloodsport. Let's not forget that. But
yeah, that shit rules.
I guess most of my... The Delta Force, they produced that.
I own it on DVD.
A lot of my feelings about Golan and Globus come from Superman 4. But the Masters of the Universe movie, I was a big He-Man fan as a kid. I really enjoyed the Masters of the Universe cartoon, despite it being objectively terrible.
Completely terrible. Like, to its credit, really good designs, amazing background paintings. Everything else about it is trash garbage.
Yeah, we watched the He-Man, She-Ra animated movie as our very first non-Bandcamp Movie Fighters film. And that was a slog. But I remember when this movie came out, the live-action movie, my big complaint about it, four-year-old me, was particularly upset by how little it seemed to resemble the cartoon. It is a very different animal from animated He-Man and the Masters of the Universe.
You were a He-Man fan when you were younger. I was a He-Man fan when you were younger, but when you were younger, yes. Also when I was younger is what I meant to say there. but I only know that because my mom remembers buying me He-Man toys when I was like three. I do not remember being into He-Man. I barely remember being into G.I. Joe as a kid before I came back to it as a teenager and read all the comics. But Masters of the Universe is something that I have no attachment to. I think we talked about that during the He-Man and She-Ra movie episode. But what I've seen of this movie, it does look like a very different thing because He-Man comes to Earth, right?
Yes, which is not something that happens at all in the cartoon. There are like cities in it. And then it's also far more outer spacey than the He-Man cartoon is. Like the He-Man cartoon takes place in almost like a generic fantasy universe, right?
Well, it's like a weird fantasy sci-fi universe.
Right, because there are like... Yeah, it's supposed to be like another planet. It's the planet Eternia. But Eternia is a kind of a fantasy setting with castles and magicians and sorceresses and and warriors and beast men.
And there's just, you know, occasionally robots and tanks.
Yeah.
It's everything kids like. It's swords, it's tanks, it's skeleton men.
For the most part, though, it is in a fantasy milieu. This movie is so much more spacey. Like, even down to the plot being about, like, a cosmic key. MacGuffin.
Like Stardust Cosmic Key?
Yeah.
Like the tag team championships?
Yeah, this movie's all about the tag team championships. Did you know that, Chris?
Oh, no, that's very exciting, though.
Now, one thing we talked about, because we actually decided to watch this movie kind of on the fly, just talking about it when we were recording War Rocket Ajax this week. And one thing that came up was how much it sort of seems to be a Jack Kirby's Fourth World movie.
That's the thing that I've always heard about this movie, is that it's a He-Man movie in name. It's a He-Man movie in that it has a guy named He-Man. It's got Skeletor in it. But it is very much more inspired by New Gods, by Orion coming to Earth, which has made me really interested in seeing it, even though I've heard that it's bad.
That theory, well, it comes from two places. The first one is John Byrne.
Okay.
Who said in an issue of Comic Shop News that the best New Gods movie is Masters of the Universe. And he said that he had corresponded with the director, Gary Goddard, who said that his intent was that he tried to get Jack Kirby to do the production designs, but the studio said no.
I mean, that's interesting because the figures are very Kirby-ish. Like, the Master of the Universe toys do seem very, very Kirby-ish in their designs.
Of course,
I think we should put the caveat on that, which is that John Byrne says a lot of things.
Sure. But then, in an issue of John Byrne's Next Men, Gary Goddard wrote a letter to John Byrne that says, your comparison to the film to Kirby's New Gods was not far off. The storyline was greatly inspired by the classic Fantastic Four, Doctor Doom epics, the New Gods, and a bit of Thor thrown in here and there.
Okay, well then this should be our favorite movie.
I intended the film to be a motion picture comic book, though it was a tough proposition to sell to the studio at the time. Comics are just for kids, they thought. Not anymore. Bang pow. They would not allow me to hire Jack Kirby, who I desperately wanted to be the conceptual artist for the picture. And then he goes on to talk about a little bit about how he grew up with Jack Kirby comics. John Byrne also lists several analogs of who the characters are supposed to be. Like, Metron is the dwarf character. Sorceress is Highfather, and obviously Skeletor is Darkseid.
Right.
I don't know. We'll see how it lines up when we watch.
Okay, on the one hand, this sounds amazing. On the other hand, can you even imagine the Jack Kirby Canon Films team up in the finer world where that happened?
I mean, it would really be something. Given the budget of so many of these movies, I really wonder how they would try to realize a Jack Kirby design.
That is an excellent question, Matt, but I feel like we've missed out on so much Kirby stuff in the real world. Like you know about the amusement park, the science fiction land that was supposed to be in Colorado,
right?
Where it would literally just be like Jack Kirby stuff in real life that they later used for the secret CIA mission as seen in Argo. But I wish there had been like full on Kirby stuff in a movie before like 2014. Cause that's really when we got it, right? Was when Exitar the Exterminator showed up in Guardians of the Galaxy, when a Celestial was running around for a little bit.
I mean, the designs in the Thor movies are fairly Kirby-ish.
That's true. They're that kind of sci-fi Asgard. Now, can I ask you a question, Matt?
Sure.
Because Cannon Films is the studio that made Masters of the Universe.
Right.
Have you watched the Cannon Films documentary that is on Netflix?
It is in my queue, and I'm fully intending to watch it, but I have not watched it yet.
I do not want to spoil it for you.
Okay.
It has the best possible ending. Like it's good, and then it's a little sad and depressing, and then it gets amazing in, like, the last 10 minutes. It gets wonderful.
Oh, that's very intriguing.
I do think it's interesting that we're getting to Cannon, because I don't know if we've done a Cannon film, which is weird, because Cannon films are 100% in the movie fighter's wheelhouse. Like I said, this is the studio that brought you, what was it? Enter the Ninja, Revenge of the Ninja, and Ninja 3: The Domination. Those are top notch.
Sure.
Delta Force, as you said, great stuff. So many video store aisles just full of Cannon films. And we have talked before about how Movie Fighters is the show that you listen to if you have fond memories of walking down the video store aisle and being scared of the cover of Dr. Giggles. If that describes you, congratulations, you're our demo.
That's true.
So I'm glad that we're finally getting around to Cannon. I'm very excited about it.
Well, this is a good entry. This is a good meeting point between schlocky VHS movies and the kind of comics-related nerdy stuff that we did at Comics Alliance and have done a lot of since. So let's see how it goes with Masters of the Universe from 1987. Before we do that, Chris, though, we've got to get to our snack situation. That's right. This is the hottest segment in all of podcasting. Snack situation. Chris, what are you snacking on for Masters of the Universe?
I have a prime snack situation going on here.
Okay.
I have a snack situation that will make me the envy of our listeners, because I am sitting here looking down at a slice of homemade pie.
Mmm. What kind of pie? What kind of pie you got over there?
I have what is called black bottom oatmeal pie. It is basically a pecan pie, but instead of pecans, it's got oatmeal on the top. So it's kind of like eating a pie and an oatmeal cookie, and it is topped with homemade whipped cream by my lovely lady friend Aiden Sullivan. That's this from the kitchen.
That sounds absolutely delicious and wonderful.
Now, unfortunately, I don't have a cup of coffee to go with this pie because, as you can probably tell from our voices, I think Matt and I are both a little bit sick still. So I can't drink coffee. I'm on like week three without coffee, and it's terrible, and I hate it. So I did suck down some herbal tea a little bit to round out the snack situation on this side of the call. Matt, what's your sitch, buddy? What's your snack sitch?
Well, when you rise, I fall, I think. I am kind of having to do what's best for me in this snack situation, and thus I am holding a bag of Ricola Lemon Mint Herb Throat Drops.
Okay.
Naturally soothing relief that lasts from Switzerland.
All right. Look, I appreciate your situation. That is not a snack. I'm going to say that does not count as a snack.
Well, I have some candy in front of me as well that I'm going to snack on. I have a bag of Starbursts. I'm going to kind of like reach around the various snacks that I have around me and snack on those when I'm not sucking on cough drops.
Do you have a snack arrangement? Is that what you're telling me?
I do have a snack arrangement. And then I've also got, if I want to like chew on something that's a little bready, I do have some trefoils, some Girl Scout shortbread cookies.
We talk about this on a previous episode? You were an advocate of the trefoils.
Yes, we have talked at length about Girl Scout cookies, and I have given my stamp of approval to the shortbread/trefoil Girl Scout cookie. To me, It's them and Samoas, and then everything else below.
It sounds like you have a better snack situation than you were letting on, but it's still true. Not as good as mine. Still not as good as mine.
But I'm mainly going to be sucking on these cough drops. I cannot lie. Okay.
I should go get some Ricolas. TBQH.
All right. Now that we have done our snack situation and we've done a little setup, we are going to dive in to 1987's Masters of the Universe. We're going to take a little break and hear a little musical interlude. You can watch along with us if you rent the movie online. Back in just a sec to talk about the movie. And we are back from watching Masters of the Universe.
Yeah, here's a cool piece of trivia that I found out about this movie. Matt, are you ready?
Hit me.
It fucking rules.
My patented laugh cough. You got it out of me.
That's a good one. Yeah, this movie's great. This movie's awesome.
It is awesome in one sense of the word. And not so great in other senses of the word. But let's run through it. Let's run through the details, because there's not...
Right, so we're going to go ahead and hit the plot. Now, one thing that we didn't talk about at all before we went to go watch it was the cast.
Correct.
Which I had kind of forgotten about this movie's sort of legendary cast.
Well, up front and center, you got Dolph Lundgren.
The Punisher.
The Punisher himself.
The Punish Man. Dolph Lundgren.
Ivan Drago. Hitting it up as He-Man. Not really saying much dialogue-wise. Kind of only there to fit the bill visually.
Not a lot of dialogue. And what dialogue there is, I will say, not heavily accented, but distractingly accented.
If I could describe it with one word, it would be fuzzy. But I feel like
fuzzy is a good word for it.
All the dialogue in this movie is kind of fuzzy. Like, even like Skeletor, who is played by Frank Langella, who is like a for real actor who is in many, many movies and has won awards for acting. He's Skeletor. He's so heavily made up that it looks like he can barely move his mouth. And he's unrecognizable under all that.
Yeah, he's.
As well.
It's a very weird mask because he's less a skeleton. Like, listen, because, okay, Skeletor is not a skeleton either. Skeletor just has no skin on his face.
Right.
But it's more like his skin has been, like, dried and drawn in. Like he looks like he has skin.
He looks like a melted candle.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to describe it.
It's a weird look. I mean, he's believably evil looking and threatening looking, I guess. But not necessarily skeleton like. And there's a couple shots where his mask where he's got the two nose holes, it's clearly just covering his nose.
Yeah, it's very clearly a mask. Yeah. I think you can say that about it pretty easily.
Now, then you've got some actors that I'm not as familiar with as the other Eternia folks. Meg Foster, who's apparently kind of a mainstay of canon films, plays Evil Lynn, who I described as looking like Gozer.
Yeah, you are not wrong.
The sorceress, whose only job in this movie is to stand around because she has been captured by Skeletor, is played by Christina Pickles. She doesn't do very
Great
much.
Name.
She doesn't
name.
Do very much except for get progressively more aged looking throughout the movie as she loses her power. Chelsea Field plays Tila. A very different kind of Tila than we recall from the cartoon or other things. Here she is like mercenary warrior Tila, like Space Ranger Teela.
I don't think mercenary is quite right, but we'll get to that when we get to the plot.
She is played by Chelsea Field, who, according to her Wikipedia page, has been in, you know, a few movies, but is mainly notable, it seems, for being married to Scott Bakula.
Wow. Are they still married?
Still married.
Wow. Well, that's nice.
She's had a run of being in movies that are considered to be the worst movies.
Okay, what else is she in?
Harley Davidson and the Marlboro Man.
Okay, yeah, that's a rough one.
The Last Boy Scout.
The Bruce Willis movie?
The Bruce Willis movie.
Okay.
She's in a movie called Extreme Justice. Those are the
two. Is it based on the comic of the same name?
I sincerely doubt it. That's a Lou Diamond Phillips movie.
Does Lou Diamond Phillips play Booster Gold?
Her last movie was from 2008. It was called Just Add Water.
That sounds fun. That sounds well. Fortunately, she's in the best movie I've ever seen, which is this movie that we're talking about right now.
Gwildor, who's a dwarf man who created the MacGuffin of this movie. That's Billy Barty.
Famous, like maybe the most famous little person actor.
It's him and Warwick Davis, or Warwick.
Well, yeah,
Davis.
I guess Warwick Davis probably now. Get, you know, in a post Harry Potter world, but certainly at the time of this movie, Billy Barty would have been a get.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say it'd still be him and Warwick Davis even at the time of this movie, because you had like Willow and stuff like that. But yeah, it's always
Billy
been pretty
Barty, close. Old Hollywood, my
very
friend.
Very old Hollywood. And then on Earth, we've got Courtney Cox.
First off the set of the Dancing in the Dark video.
Yeah, she just got finished dancing with Bruce Springsteen, and now here she is.
Hey. Can't start a fire without a spark, Matt.
Too true. The Robert Duncan McNeil plays her boyfriend, Kevin Corrigan.
Not the comedian Kevin Corrigan, which is very weird.
Yeah.
There's Robert a part in this movie where someone says, like, if you break up with Kevin Corrigan, you're going to regret it.
Robert Duncan McNeil, who has been a working actor, like, working hard his entire career, both as an actor and a director. Then, as Detective Lubick, we have James Tolkien, whose name you might not know, but you will recognize as every authority figure who's kind of a tough guy who's bald from every 80s movie.
Is he Mr. Strickland?
Yeah, that's him.
He looks shorter. He looks shorter than everyone in this movie, but then you realize that he's mostly playing against Michael J. Fox, so it's very difficult to tell.
He's
in fact the same guy.
He is Principal Strickland from Back to the Future. Yes, absolutely, 100%.
Let's get into the plot. The first thing we see, Matt, is what I described as some video made by your church opening titles.
And I described them as corporate training video opening titles. It is that kind of graphics.
I thought I was about to learn how to say no to drugs. You thought you were about to learn how to make a hamburger the Wendy's way.
That's right. What I think we should note right up front is that this is a very plot-thin film. It is not heavy on the plot, because probably the middle half of the movie is just somebody gets the cosmic key, then there's a firefight where somebody else is trying to get the cosmic key, then somebody else has it, and then there's another firefight to get the cosmic key. Like, that is the entire middle of the movie. Just the cosmic key being passed between people and people fighting over it.
Yeah. That's pretty much it. For about 45 minutes?
I mean, I said an hour, but it's give or take. So
yeah, it bounces back and forth quite a bit.
We open on Eternia, which does not look at all like the Eternia of the cartoon. It's like a desert planet. It's kind of a barren wasteland. I said it looked like a location from the Heavy Metal movie.
Inaccurate.
There's a real heavy metal feel at the beginning of this movie. The first thing that's happened is that Skeletor has won.
Which is awesome. Which I love. Like, because this movie takes place after the cartoon. Like, because all throughout this movie, there is an implication of a long history with He-Man and Skeletor. Like He-Man, well, Skeletor at one point says, like, you know, I've hated you for years. And at one point, He-Man is like, yeah, Skeletor, it was never about them. It was always you and me. So there is this implication of a very, very long history between He-Man and Skeletor. Except that we pick up when Skeletor has won. He has conquered Eternia, which I kind of love. Because that is a thing that, if you were a fan of the show, I feel like that would be an instant way to surprise you. Like, you're not getting Prince Adam's origin story in this. In fact, you don't see Prince Adam in this movie. You only see He-Man.
There's no acknowledgement that he is Prince Adam. There's no acknowledgement that he's anything but just He-Man.
Yeah. So you're getting this kind of, like it's the... I feel like this is the kind of story that fandom in general loves to see. Like, you know, oh, like, what if the bad guys won and the good guys had to go underground? Like, that is a classic setup. And I feel like it's... If you are... You know, to this movie's credit, right? Because I feel like this movie got a lot of flack for not being the cartoon. You know, it's not a live-action version of the cartoon. But this is kind of the Dark Knight Returns of He-Man, right? Like, this is kind of the bad guys won, the good guys had to go underground. You know, Man-at-Arms and Teela are obviously, like, living rough out in the desert with guns. It's, like, I find it very appealing.
Skeletor announces to the world of Eternia through this like giant hologram thing that he has captured the sorceress, that he has taken over Castle Grayskull, and now he is in charge. And he demands that He-Man come and surrender to him. He-Man goes and finds Man-at-Arms and Teela, who are, like you said, they're kind of living rough out in the desert. They're having a hard time. And they just happen to find this guy, Gwildor, caught in a net out in the desert as well. And when they find Gwildor, Gwildor explains that he created this thing called the Cosmic Key. It looks like a really weird musical instrument with all these like keys that you can play on it that make different tones.
It looks kind of like a sex toy that RoboCop would use. I feel like is a good way to describe it.
It's like a fantasy robot sex toy.
It's like ridged and bumpy and kind of vibrate-y.
Gwildor describes himself as a Thanorian locksmith. And as such, he creates these things called cosmic keys, where if you play certain tones, because the universe is a musical place, it's made of music. If you play certain tones, you can go anywhere. You can open a portal to any place.
Yeah, which again, that is some Grant Morrison shit. That is some true. Final Crisis shit.
I mean, it's a boom tube.
Like, when they use it, it is 1,000,000% a boom tube. And also, Teela is running around with like a little mechanical rectangle on her shoulder that she pulls off later. It's a mother box.
He created the only one that exists, but Evil Lyn got to him and made a copy of the Cosmic Key that he created. And through that, Skeletor was able to invade Castle Grayskull and take it over.
Yeah, rather than – because the castle could withstand a siege, but basically Skeletor just like teleports inside and kills everybody. That's right. The implication at least, with his army of 100% stormtroopers.
You said at the beginning like that this movie was 100% Star Wars at the top. It's sort of a mix of several different – popular films of the era, because there's some Star Wars in here, there's some like Dune in here,
there's a little bit of Conan the Barbarian,
yeah,
there's a lot of New Gods, a little Doctor Doom. It is It is a movie a 12-year-old would make in a cut, like, or at least the framing parts, not necessarily the parts on Earth. The parts on Earth get weird in a very unexpected way. But like all the Eternia stuff is like a 12-year-old. Everything that, you know, everything I read when I was 12, everything I loved when I was 12, as a movie all happening at once.
It's true. So He-Man and Man-at-Arms and Teela, they go to Castle Grayskull. They try to confront Skeletor, but Skeletor is too powerful. They cannot release the Sorceress because only Skeletor can release her. Because they end up in a bind, actually Skeletor sort of turns the table on them and tries to take the cosmic key from them. So their only recourse is to just punch something into the cosmic key and go anywhere else. So Gwildor just starts pushing buttons. They open up a portal and jump through. Where do they find themselves? Planet Earth.
Which, again, I think is kind of awesome. Because we know in Masters of the Universe continuity, and again, I have not seen a lot of it, but what I have seen is the He-Man and She-Ra movie and the Christmas special. Because, of course, I've seen the Christmas special. Christmas special is great, by the way. Great Skeletor stuff. But in the Christmas special, we know that, like, Earth is, like, you can get to Earth from Eternia under some very extenuating circumstances. So the idea of, okay, now that Skeletor's won, the fight's coming to Earth, that's another thing that I feel like it raises the stakes of the movie. Like, I feel like if you were, like, a 5-year-old and you watched Masters of the Universe, because when did this come out? Like, this came out when Masters of the Universe was on TV, right? Like, or during its initial run?
Or just after. 1987 is when it came out. So it was,
okay, like,
Masters of the Universe was still a current cartoon.
Right. Because I feel like if you're 5 and you like Masters of the Universe, you're probably not going to like this movie because you're not going to see the stuff that you recognize in the cartoon. Skeletor is different. He-Man's different. You know, they spend a lot of time on Earth with, like, kids with their real-life problems dealing with the death of their parents. But if you're, like, if this movie would have come out in, like, 1992, right? Like, if you were, like, 12 and you used to like Masters of the Universe, I feel like you would really like this movie.
This is the point I was going to make, like, in final thoughts or whatever. Like, I think this movie may have been saddled by coming out too early.
Yeah. Like, this movie is kind of the perfect, you know, PG-13 version for kids who are growing out of the original thing. The problem is that He-Man and the, like, Masters of the Universe cartoon is for babies.
Yeah,
like, I mean, straight up for babies.
That's the other thing where it's like, this is such a childish property that it's almost impossible to make it mature. So when you have Skeletor talking to a character whose name is He-Man,
right,
it sounds inherently silly, and there's not a really good way to make it not sound silly in a way that somehow, you know, Batman and Captain America can be serious, but He-Man cannot. Yeah. And even Skeletor and Evil Lyn, like, they're too, I don't know, childish. The names are too childish. The concepts are too cartoony silly to really get there.
I think we would give you, like, Skeletor. We would give you Beastman, even. Like, Beastman is kind of pushing it, but He-Man is, like, right out. Like, that's the one that breaks it in terms of names. Like, no, like, this is for tiny babies.
Yeah. So they go to Earth, and they find themselves on Earth safe, but they can't find the cosmic key. Somehow the cosmic key got lost in the transfer. So we get a comedy scene where Man-at-Arms, Teela, and Gwildor go to the restaurant where Courtney Cox works.
Oh, you're talking about Robbie's Ribs?
Robbie's Ribs, which also serves chicken, seafood, burgers, hot dogs. They
milkshakes.
Really have an overloaded menu there.
Yeah, Gordon Ramsay's going to throw a fucking fit, man.
No kidding. But they go to this restaurant, and there's this extended joke about how Man-at-Arms is hungry. So they go get some food at Robbie's, and they're eating the food, and then Teela is disgusted to find out that they're eating an animal. Because she asks, like, why do they put it on this white stick? And Man-at-Arms is like, no, that's a bone. And Teela's like, what? Ugh. That's a gag in the movie.
Yeah, this is the part in my notes where I wrote down, do you think Man-at-Arms has ever eaten a man? Because there's a joke earlier, like, you know, Teela's like, oh, Dad, you're always hungry. And he's like, hey, I survived, you know, the siege of such and such 30 days with no rations. And then, like, 5 minutes later, they're eating ribs and Teela's all grossed out because, you know, she's a vegan, obviously. And Man-at-Arms goes, it's best not to think about it when you're hungry. And I'm like, oh, that's a cannibal talking. Like, that is yep. Cannibal talk.
100%. So Courtney Cox is at work, and she's talking to this coworker she has, where she's telling her – they're talking about how it's her last day at work. She's moving away to New Jersey just to kind of get away from her life, and she's going to break up with her boyfriend Kevin to move away because she's had a rough year. Because what she does after she leaves work is she gets in the car with Kevin and they drive immediately to the cemetery so she can go see her parents' graves one last time before she moves away. We find out that they died in a plane crash that she blames herself for. Because on the day that they – because I guess her dad flies a private plane, like owns his own private plane and is a pilot – they asked her to come with the beach to them on this particular day. She said no, she had to study because she wanted to hang out with Kevin instead. So they got on a plane and flew to Catalina and crashed and died. So she blames herself for their deaths.
Yeah, which after seeing, you know, He-Man and Skeletor and Castle Grayskull and all this fantasy stuff and dudes who look like stormtroopers. They actually look like the gunners on the Death Star. It is those exact outfits.
Yeah, that is exactly what they're not stormtroopers. They're those guys.
Yeah. After seeing all of that, then cutting to Earth and seeing Courtney Cox being like, yeah, I blame myself for my parents' death because I lied to them. Like, it is a bonkers tone shift.
Speaking of tone shifts, we immediately, as they're leaving the cemetery, they notice the cosmic key. And I guess he's trying to play it cool. Kevin identifies this cosmic key. Kevin, who we find out is a musician. He's in a band. He identifies the cosmic key as one of those new Japanese synthesizers. And he starts like messing around with the keys.
Cylindrical Japanese synthesizer is covered in tuning forks.
Yeah, with like saxophone keys on it. And he's like, I'm going to take this over to the music store, to Charlie's, so he can like check this thing out for me. Meanwhile, Courtney Cox goes to the high school because Kevin's going to have a concert there.
Yeah, it's going to be like the school dance. Now, back on Eternia, it turns out that Skeletor has a way of tracking the usage of the cosmic key. So, like, all of Kevin and Courtney Cox's noodling. What is Courtney Cox's name? I do not remember.
Julie.
That's right, because I kept thinking, me Julie, because it's a topical current reference. All of Kevin and Julie's noodling on it is being detected by Skeletor back in Eternia. So he can pinpoint where they are and open up his own boom tube. And so he sends his three best soldiers, right? He sends a guy named Blade, who is not Wesley Snipes, who nope. looks like the opposite of Wesley Snipes, in fact.
He looks kind of like a thinner, younger James Tolkien, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, kind of.
He's bald. He's a bald guy. He's got this weird eye patch.
Like, he just looks like a Mad Max dude.
That is 100% right. He also sucks. Blade is terrible.
He sucks real bad. I guess he sends four guys. So he sends Blade, he sends some lizard dude, he sends this other guy whose name I don't remember, who looks like Kabuki Quantum Fighter.
Do you want to know what that dude looks like? His name is Karg.
Karg? I don't know. Like, I don't know if he's from the cartoon or not. And he sends Beastman, who is, like, just straight up Kalibak.
The only one who is from the cartoon is Beastman. And, like, Manny Faces, not here. Not in this.
Yeah, Trapjaw, Fisto, not in the house.
Not around. Only Beastman stayed. No Hordak, even.
The sequel, bro. You know that's true.
Well, Skeletor's coming back in the sequel. We'll get to that. So, yeah, they show up on Earth. And they show up in the school because they actually were playing with the Cosmic Key in the school before Kevin decided to go have Charlie check out this thing at the music store. So they arrive at the school. They beat the shit out of a coach. This poor coach who's just waiting for the dance to start so he can chaperone.
He's the janitor, like, they say. They say he's the janitor. Okay. Later.
All right.
Throw him face first through a wall.
He gets bloodied. He does not have a good day. But Courtney Cox manages to evade them by crawling under the stage. And fucking terrible Blade can't manage to hit her with a sword to save his life. Then He-Man, Man-at-Arms, and Teela show up, and they fight off the henchmen. Meanwhile, Kevin is over at Charlie's having Charlie check out the Cosmic Key. And Charlie's also trying to play it cool and say, like, I think this thing might be Japanese. And Kevin's like, I don't think so. Where do you think it's from? And Charlie's has no idea. After all the fighting is done, Julie, He-Man, Teela, and Man-at-Arms go meet up with Kevin at Charlie's and say, like, hey, something crazy is going on.
Matt, you just skipped like a third of this movie. I know that it's very repetitive.
Yeah, I mean, this is the part of the movie where it starts being like, somebody has the Cosmic Key, there's a fight, somebody else gets the Cosmic Key, there's a fight. I mean, look, here's the progression as I know it. It goes from Kevin to the cop, Detective Lubick, because Detective Lubick shows up at the school after the big fight.
Right, because Kevin, when he's at Charlie's, hears that there's like something that went down at the school, which was the attack by Skeletor's forces. They have a big, big fight with He-Man and his crew, and the whole place gets like super fucked up. So they hear that they're, you know, he hears that Kevin hears that there's a possible arson, possible vandalism situation going on. So he's worried about Julie. So that's when he goes and he takes that cop. That's where he meets Lubick, the cop. And then for some reason, they go to Julie's house. And then Julie calls her own house looking for Kevin, even though no one lives at Julie's house.
Except Julie,
because her parents are dead.
Right, like she calls her house expecting somebody to answer. Kevin answers, and she's like, oh, thank God you picked up, as if she just knew he was going to be there. When he should be performing in concert at this point, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, she knows he's not at the gym, because the gym has been destroyed
by a fight
with fucking Beast Man, who gets some bleach thrown in his eyes, his one weakness.
I think it's because they could only have one set. Like, conceivably, he should have gone back to his own house. So this should have taken place at Kevin's house. But they probably only had one house set. So they had to have him go to Julie's house. Anyway, he gets into a whole scuffle with the cop, Detective Lubick. And Detective Lubick ends up taking the Cosmic Key because he thinks it's stolen. He thinks it's some kind of stolen contraband.
Yeah.
Taking it back to the police station.
He takes it back to Charlie's because Kevin tells him that Kevin tells him the whole story. He tells him, hey, I found this thing at the cemetery, which sounds weird, I know, but I was trying to find out if it was somebody's. So I took it to the music store. I took it to Charlie's to see if he could post a notice. And that's when I heard the news and came to the school and met you. So then Lubick, aka 100% Dan Turpin, as I realize later in the movie. Lubick then goes back to Charlie's because, like you said, there's three sets on Earth. I guess there's Robbie's, so there's four sets. There's the gym, Charlie's, Julie's house, and Robbie's ribs and chicken and seafood and milkshakes and hot dogs and hamburgers.
At that moment, after Lubick leaves, Skeletor's forces return, and this time Evil Lyn is with them. Because back on Eternia, there's that... This is the most cartoon moment of the movie. Because Skeletor's henchmen have failed, and he is chewing them out. He is telling them that they're buffoons and idiots, and they should know better. And he ends up actually disintegrating the lizard guy. He honestly should be disintegrating Blade, because he's the one that sucks the worst. But he disintegrates the lizard guy instead, as a warning to the rest of them that they really got to get this cosmic key back. I don't fully understand why Skeletor needs this other cosmic key, though. Is he just trying to get it away from He-Man? Because he has a working cosmic key, the copy. So why does he want the other one so bad?
He has one of his own, but if He-Man has it, He-Man can do the same trick that Skeletor did.
Yeah,
you know, so just teleport into the Castle of Grayskull and kill Skeletor.
He's just trying to get it away from He-Man.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Evil Lyn pipes up and says, like, well, here's something they could do, or here's a suggestion of what, how, like, maybe they can get it back this time. And Skeletor's like, okay, you're going with him. And Evil Lyn's like, no, I wasn't saying that I wanted to go. And he's like, well, you shouldn't have suggested anything. Go. That is like the most cartoon Skeletor, where he's just kind of like this shitty manager who has bad employees.
Yes.
That's cartoon Skeletor to a T. So he sends all of them back. Evil Lynch shows up at Kevin's house. They snap this like truth collar on him and interrogate him with the truth collar on. And he leads them back to Charlie's, to the police officer, so they start giving chase.
After it's not until we're talking about it that I'm realizing how convoluted the middle of this movie is.
Yeah, it's just a lot of, like, passing the cosmic key back and forth. He-Man and the rest of them show up at the house. They talk to Kevin, who is still wearing the collar. He says who showed up, describes Evil Lyn. Teela immediately recognizes that that's Evil Lyn. And they realize that they got to get back to Charlie's. Also, Gwildor shows up in this, like, souped-up, tricked-out Cadillac.
Yeah,
He stole a car. But it's also, like, some kind of future space car.
Like, I think he calls it a land boat, which I think is kind of funny.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, he – because it's always on fire. Like, it's always, like, sparking everywhere. In for no reason when they drive it around, and it has this, when they turn it off, it has this like jet engine cooldown sound.
Yeah, and it's just got weird lights and stuff on it. I mean, I guess the implication is that he souped it up really quickly.
Yeah, I think that's because he's, you know, supposed to be this genius inventor. I mean, he does build a new cosmic key out of a fucking Casio keyboard later on in the movie.
Yeah. So everybody convenes at Charlie's. There's a huge firefight at Charlie's, and from there, the cosmic key actually kind of gets destroyed. It's like nobody really ends up with it. It just gets zapped, and I guess Skeletor is pretty satisfied at that point because really he just wanted to get the cosmic key away from He-Man.
Yeah, and he needs He-Man back on Eternia as a prisoner. Like he actually kind of justifies it. Like there's a big conversation where, like right at the beginning of the movie, where Evil Lyn's like, okay, so we're gonna go and kill He-Man then? And Skeletor goes, no, I can't kill him. He will become a martyr, and the people will use him as a symbol to rise up and rebel against me. I need to humble him. So he's gonna like enslave He-Man and make him kneel before him, make sure everybody sees it to consolidate his reign. That's one weirdly kind of sophisticated justification for this movie's plot. The other, like, the whole firefight at Charlie's music store goes on for a real long time and is very complicated. Like, there's a scene where they take Lubick's gun away, and then Tila's got a gun on him because he's like, he doesn't want to deal with all these super mucky mucks. And then at one point, Tila has to go join the fight. So she's like, hey, you, Kevin, take this gun, hold it on this cop, and make sure this cop doesn't get away, which is a weird thing to ask of someone. Then there's this part where Julie's dead mother shows up and gets her to give her the key. But then it's not Julie's dead mother. It's Evil Lynn in disguise preying on Julie's desire to have her parents not be dead. Like, it's a very complex set of stuff going on in that firefight.
There's also a
gun battle going on.
There's also a moment where Tila joins the gun battle, starts shooting some henchmen, then looks directly at the camera and says, more like woman at arms.
So great. So genuinely fucking great.
I actually really like the actress who plays Tila in this. She's good. Chelsea Field. She's good.
A lot of fun. She is clearly that. There's a lot of people looking directly into the camera and saying things, and that's the best one.
Yes. So, once they have secured the cosmic key, Skeletor shows up on Earth in his, like, floating throne.
In his Jabba's sail barge.
He's got, like, a litter, but he doesn't need people carrying it. It's just kind of floating on its own. Where he can seize He-Man and take him back to Eternia. So, he gets He-Man, and they go back to Eternia, and he, like, makes He-Man kneel before him. He makes one of his henchmen whip He-Man with this, like, laser whip.
And part of that is that he tells He-Man on Earth, hey, you guys are all surrounded. You have no cosmic key. I have clearly won. But if you come back to Eternia with me, I will leave Tila, Man-at-Arms, Julie, Kevin, I will leave all of them alone here on Earth. They can stay on Earth and rot here, but you need to come with me. And He-Man's like, yeah, this is our fight, and I can't let it endanger this planet anymore. And that's when He-Man goes back and gets whipped in a, I'm going to say, surprisingly erotic scene.
And surprisingly violent, because he's got, like,
surprisingly violent,
big, like, red, bleeding lash marks on his back. Like, it's the Passion of the Christ.
Yeah, for the rest of the movie. But, like, Skeletor watching this, he's, like, sitting in his throne, right? And he's got his big staff, like the big ram head staff. But he's got that, like, planted on the ground kind of to the side, and he's kind of turning away and holding onto it. And so he's kind of, like, looking over his shoulder at He-Man being whipped. And it's very weird. Like, Skeletor is obviously, like, this is a very pleasurable occurrence for him. Like, it's not necessarily sexual, but also Dolph Lundgren is standing there in, like, trunks, like the tiniest fans, being whipped in front of this man who's, like, super into it. So it's a little weird. I think it works, though. I honestly think it works.
it fits in the heavy metal milieu of the movie.
Yeah, straight up, it does.
So, on Earth, so they take He-Man, and even that's explained, kinda, where Skeletor's like, look, if I kill them, then I lose my leverage over He-Man. Like, right, I just break him then. And I want to be able to like, give him a reason to have to bow in front of me, because otherwise he has nothing to lose. So just let them live. And just bring He-Man with me. So, Tila, Man-at-Arms, Kevin, and Julie, and Gwildor are all still on Earth, and they're trying to figure out what to do. Also, there's the added complication of Julie got hit with something during the firefight that's like poison, and it is going to kill her. How did she get hurt on her leg? So that she's like poisoned.
I thought that was when that might have been during the fight with the air centurions. That might, like, I kind of thought that was from when she was with Evil Lynn, because like Evil Lynn turns back into Evil Lynn after she gets the cosmic key, and I thought that's when that happened to Julie, but I honestly do not know.
It's not super clear. There's a lot going on during that firefight, so it's kind of easy to miss when that exactly that happens. But she's like sitting on a bench, and she's got this really nasty looking wound on her leg that is definitely going to kill her pretty soon. So Kevin is desperate to get them to Eternia because apparently the only person who can heal this thing is the sorceress. But the cosmic key is busted. And there's this weird thing that Gwildor keeps talking about how the memory, like what they have left of the cosmic key, the memory has been deleted. It's been wiped clean. So yeah, whatever,
so they don't have the frequency for Eternia anymore.
Yeah, the little tune that it plays to get them back to Eternia, they don't have it anymore. But Kevin, because he's a musician, he remembers the tune.
So the tune, all Matt, they do you remember why he remembers it? Because I wrote that shit down.
Please give us the full explanation.
It had a good hook.
So because he remembers the tune, they just need this an input, and they can hook it up to what's left of the cosmic key, and it can still open a portal. So he runs back to Charlie's, grabs a keyboard, comes back, somehow hooks up the keyboard to the cosmic key, plays the tune, and it opens this portal. So they get back to Eternia, back to Castle Grayskull, while He-Man is being humbled. Like, they don't just themselves get taken back, by the way. Oh, also Detective Lubick is with them.
Yeah, because Lubick still wants to arrest Teela and Man-at-Arms for holding him hostage with his own gun while a gunfight was going on. So he shows up with a shotgun, and he's like, hey, stop what you're doing. And Kevin's like, no, we have to get her to Eternia. And Lubick's like, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. And then they finish entering the musical notes on the keyboard, and they all get boom-tubed to Apocalypternia.
But it's not just them. It's also, like, everything within a few feet around them. So they take part of a wall of the building they're standing next to, half of Gwildor's car, a little bit of the street. It's like a diorama shows up at Eternia.
Like it's a playset.
Yeah, it is exactly a playset. So they arrive and they change the whole tenor of everything that's happening on Eternia. They give He-Man just enough of an opening, like a big firefight starts breaking out in Castle Grayskull. Skeletor is trying to stop He-Man, who is like, even though he's shackled, is trying to fight off the henchmen. So Skeletor is like, no, stop him. So he starts like shooting lightning bolts out of his hands, but instead just hits He-Man's shackles and knocks them off, which seems like some real bad aim on Skeletor's part. He probably should have done a better job there. Oh, also, we should mention here that by this point, Skeletor has drained all of the sorceress's power and now has a gold Galactus suit.
He goes full-on Jack Kirby New God Skeletor. Like, that's when I realized that he's not Darkseid. He's Doctor Doom. Like, this movie is New Gods plus Doctor Doom in terms of the Eternia stuff. Like, we talked about that a little bit before. But that is so clear here when he uses his cosmic power to turn himself into a Jack Kirby god.
Yeah. Like, that suit is super Kirby. Like, they didn't get Kirby to do the designs for this movie, but that costume is mega Jack Kirby.
Yeah, they might as well have. Like, he's got a weird hat with, like, five sets of horns. It's great. It's great.
So after He-Man gets freed, he manages to shatter Skeletor's staff, which takes him back to being, like, old-style Skeletor with his old costume, which is just, like, some, you know, robes and, like, it's still a pretty, like, badass costume, but it's not, you know, crazy horned helmet Skeletor anymore. And then they have a sword fight, which ends with Skeletor getting knocked off of a platform into a pit, which is how every 80s villain in every 80s movie dies. They fall into a pit.
Yeah. Up to and including Star Wars.
Correct. The sorceress is freed from her restraints, which is lucky that Skeletor just had to die for that to happen instead of like him actually physically having to release her. She heals Julie and offers, Gwildor offers to send Julie and Kevin back to Earth at any time that they choose. And Julie's initial response is like, nah, you can just send me back to, you know, when we came from, that's fine. And only as they're going into the portal does she say like, no, wait, no, send me back to before my parents died. Like she forgot the most important thing about her character until it was almost too late. Oh, but also Detective Lubick decides to just stay on Eternia.
Yeah, like the part where I realized he was Dan Turpin is when he shows up and the gun battle starts in Skeletor's throne room and he's like, yeah, fuck this, and just pops up from behind a wall and starts shooting dudes with a shotgun.
And then after all the final fight is complete, he's just sitting on a throne in Castle Grayskull with this short-haired lady, and he's like, I got a beautiful lady. Well, this is a great retirement. Let me just stay here. Julie goes back to Earth, even though she only at the last minute said, send me back to when before my parents died. She wakes up in her parents' house. They are alive. She immediately takes away her dad's plane keys and says like, hey, don't go on that trip. I love you. I love you very much. Please don't go on that trip. I want to go to the beach with you. Don't go to Catalina. And then she just goes running out into the street. She meets up with Kevin. They both realize that they remember going to Eternia. And then Kevin pulls out a little like blue sphere that he got from Castle Grayskull and says, hey, it was real. We really went there. Then after the credits, Skeletor pops out of some water and says that he'll be back. All right, Chris, what are our high points from the live-action Masters of the Universe movie?
Honestly, Matt, there's not a lot I didn't like about this movie. I loved I feel like the plot is kind of genuinely good and a smart thing to do, even if it was poorly timed. I feel like it's – like the visuals are very striking. I feel like Eternia looks cool. I feel like Skeletor becoming Doctor Doom as Galactus is probably the high point of the Masters of the Universe franchise.
Yeah, that part is great. That is easily my favorite part of the movie. I have some complaints about the way Skeletor is portrayed in this movie, but it's more just about like – my conception of Skeletor based on the cartoon. In general, Skeletor in this movie is pretty good.
Yeah. But I feel like he's definitely not... of what I know about Skeletor, he's not Skeletor. He's much closer to Doctor Doom.
Absolutely. Like, because...
but again, about, like, I like that too.
Cartoon Skeletor is a fuck-up. He never wins. And he's terrible at his job. He should be able to defeat He-Man and the Sorceress time and time again, and he can't get it done. Mm-hmm. But that's, I mean, that's part of being a TV cartoon. And also, he's got this high-pitched, angry voice that he talks like this because he's supposed to be a skeleton and he's supposed to be creepy. And Frank Langella doesn't play him that way at all. He plays him with this dark voice and he's kind of ominous and mean, right?
Yeah, which, as someone who likes G.I. Joe and watched a couple of live-action G.I. Joe movies, I sympathize with you on that front.
Yeah, but kind of objectively, like, if you want Skeletor to be a real threat as a villain, this is a much better portrayal of Skeletor.
Yeah, like, Frank Langella, you know, it's always kind of a joke, right? Like, you always hear about it as kind of a joke. He's pretty goddamn good as Skeletor.
He's got to fight against his makeup. And weird ADR stuff where, like, clearly his mouth is not matching what he's saying. But in general, his portrayal of Skeletor is pretty right on. Like, it works.
Yeah, his performance is highly enjoyable. I honestly thought Man-at-Arms and Teela were good characters. Gwildor was not as annoying as I suspected he would be.
Oh, I disagree on that one.
Really? He's very annoying. He's super annoying, but he was not as annoying as I expected him to be. That is what I can give him.
I can take that. I think it's like a creative way to make a movie. I think the way you describe it is right on. Like if it's the Dark Knight Returns of Masters of the Universe.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's as dumb of a script as its reputation. All right, let's talk about some of the low points from the movie.
The big one's obvious, right? And it's He-Man. Dolph Lundgren is not great. He doesn't, to be fair, he does not have a lot to work with. It's very easy to feel like, you know, hey, we got a guy who looks the part, which he does.
He has the look. That's about it.
He has the look. We do not have to let him talk at all.
And he barely does.
Which is fair, you know. He does look the part, but, like, he is very uninteresting. There's two times in this movie where he says He-Man's catchphrase, where he says, you know, I have the power. And the first time he gets it, he kind of fucks it up. Like, when he does it at the very end of the movie, when he's inside the little Eternia keychain, it sounds great. But in the battle with fucking Skeletor when he does it, which should be the moment of the movie that we've all been waiting for, he does not deliver the catchphrase well. Which, and again, you could also blame that on the director for not doing a second take on that. But maybe that was the best take. Maybe that was the best 1 out of 10.
That's something you brought up while we were watching it that I think is another low point. There's a lot of points in this movie where it was like, why didn't you guys do another take of this?
A lot of the action is like that. Like, there's a slow motion shot in the gunfight in Charlie's where, you know, He-Man or He-Man's stunt double, like, does a big flying leap over, I guess, a piano or something to get out of gunfire. And he almost clears it. Like, he almost gets over without knocking something over in the background, but not quite. And I was like, you could have reset that one, I think.
Another low point for me is, and this is coming from someone who liked the cartoon as a kid. There are a lot of unnecessary changes to the cartoon that don't really change the movie formally. It's almost just like, these are the costumes we could get. So, like, you know, Beast Man is in this. But all the other Skeletor henchmen are not henchmen from the cartoon. They're just new characters that are made up for the movie. And I don't know why. Like, why couldn't they have been Skeletor's normal henchmen? What materially do you benefit from that change? Why is Gwildor not Orko? Like, they're both fucking obnoxious, terrible characters, right? So why couldn't he be Orko?
I don't know Orko's deal, because Gwildor exists solely for the MacGuffin of the Cosmic Key, right? Like, is that something Orko could have done?
Sure. I mean, he's a magic character. Like, he could have just magicked stuff. Like, you know, like, you could have made that character something else. I assume it's probably a budget thing. Like, it's easier to have, like, a little alien dwarf guy instead of a floating magic invisible thing in a robe.
Yeah, I feel like the floating is probably it, because you could still have Billy Barty play Orko. Like Gwildor's voice is not too far off from Orko's.
That's the thing. Like, I hate that Gwildor is annoying. I also hate that he's not Orko. you're going to annoy me, at least push my fan button somehow.
On the subject of, like, budget and costumes, like, is Karg, who's, like, a weird Ukla the Mach-looking guy, like, is that more budget-conscious than getting, you know, Trapjaw or one of the other guys?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm asking. Like, it's almost like a distinction without a difference, right? It's the Taka and Rezar of this movie. Like, Like, you could have had Bebop and Rocksteady easy. Why are they in that movie? I don't get it. It's a confusing thing that seems almost like a poke in the eye to the fans who are going to want to see this movie.
Also, you mentioned Frank Langella fighting against his makeup. I think it's okay, but it's very clearly obstructing a performance in a lot of scenes. And there's a lot of close-ups where he's talking and he's acting his blessed heart out, and you can just see like, oh, there's just like fabric over his nose. Like, that's literally just like a scream mask over his nose.
I mean, the same goes for Billy Barty. Like, the mask that he has to wear.
Terrible.
Yeah, like, he's clearly struggling under his makeup, too. Like, everybody who's wearing a costume like that is kind of having a rough time, having a rough go of it throughout the movie. I'll say this for low points, too. It seems weird to me that they took Masters of the Universe, which is like a sword and sorcery kind of thing, and just loaded it up with laser guns. I guess it's more expedient to do your action sequences that way, but He-Man literally does not pull his sword off of his back until over an hour into the movie.
Yeah, for the sword to be such a He-Man thing, and maybe it's that they were saving it for the final battle, and maybe it's just that it's very easy to point a laser gun at something and then like, oh, there's an explosion and some guys blow up, than it is for like Dolph Lundgren as a, you know, as your child's hero to be running around like fucking stabbing dudes.
Like, I wouldn't even mind it if it was just Man-at-Arms and Teela using the lasers, but it's everybody.
Yeah, a lot of laser guns.
All right, let's do final thoughts on Masters of the Universe.
There was a point in this movie, Matt, and I wrote down the conversation we had. There was a point in this movie where the Air Centurions are flying around on Earth trying to kill He-Man and Teela and Man-at-Arms. And I asked you, since you're a He-Man fan and you watched it as a kid, I said, Matt, do you remember He-Man riding a flying surfboard a lot? And you said, I do not. And I said, that's because the cartoon is bullshit and this movie rules.
I mean, it's hard to argue that.
This movie's so much better than its reputation. Like, shockingly, so much more enjoyable. Like, it's not good. And I think going into it thinking like, oh, this is going to be, you know, a stealth New Gods movie. Like, you're not getting that either. It's not by any means. No.
It does not reach that level at all.
Yeah, but it is super fun and like fun enough that, like I said, until we were talking about it, I didn't quite realize how convoluted it gets at the end, which is
the middle is a little doughy. I think you could just go straight from there's the cosmic key, Kevin and Julie have it. It ends up in the hands of Evil Lyn, and then it gets destroyed. Like, you could cut out some of that passing it around in there, which just feels like time that's unnecessary, like excuses for more battles, which you kind of don't need. But beyond that, I think we pinpointed why this movie has the reputation it does. And I said it at the very beginning. This came out in 1987. Masters of the Universe was still a thing. And this is so markedly different from Masters of the Universe, the cartoon, that it just didn't click with audiences. Like, there's a point in this when I said, like, what audience is this for? And you ended up saying it was for you, which is accurate. But, like,
yes.
But, like, the kids who love Masters of the Universe aren't going to like it because it's not the cartoon. It's like weird outer space stuff that's not in the cartoon. Most of the movie takes place on Earth. There's like stuff about weird MacGuffins that's not in the cartoon. And a lot of the characters that you like aren't in it and are replaced with other characters that are just kind of randomly there. If you're an adult taking your kid to see this movie, there's all this hinted at and mentioned backstory that is never fleshed out. Mm-hmm. But it makes you feel like it's a sequel. It makes you feel like you missed a first movie. You know?
it is very much for me. Like, it is very much for someone who has an awareness of He-Man and has seen, you know, three or four He-Man episodes, She-Ra episodes, but has no particular attachment to them, like, doesn't want to see any of that stuff, but does want to see the kind of PG-13 version of that.
Yeah, like, if you saw the Sorceress in captivity and you had an awareness of who the Sorceress is, then that means something to you. But if you don't know that she's the reason that He-Man is He-Man and is, like, the force that oversees Castle Grayskull, then your feelings just gonna be like, who the fuck is that? Why does this lady matter? You know?
Right. It's a weird little bit of a mixed bag.
It is ultimately a fun watch when you divorce it from I'm 5 years old and they made my favorite cartoon into a movie. Oh wait, it's not that at all.
Yeah. I feel like Dylan Todd would love this movie.
Our friend Dylan Todd.
Well, Dylan is a guy, you know, Dylan is a guy who loves Star Wars to the point where he's the guy who likes the prequels. He's a guy who loves the lore of Masters of the Universe and how complicated and weird it is, but doesn't love the TV show or the comics. He's a guy who's, you know, super into Kirby and the New Gods. Like, I feel like if that's in your wheelhouse, which, you know, it is for me, I think to a lesser extent it is for you, to a lesser extent because you have memories of the show, not because you don't like those other things. But, like, you know, you, me, Dylan Todd, like, guys like us, I feel like this is a very enjoyable movie for us.
I think watching it now, especially that since I've gone back and watched Masters of the Universe, the cartoon, and realized that it sucks, I can accept this movie much more than I could when it came out. Or even years later when it sort of still left that bad taste in my mouth, you know? We'll ask Dylan what he thinks of this movie after this episode goes up. How about that?
We should do that. We should absolutely do that.
All right. That does it for this episode of Movie Fighters. We fought Masters of the Universe. We may continue Mattel March Madness in our next episode. We may keep going on a Dolph Lundgren trip. We still haven't seen the Dolph Lundgren Punisher, Chris. We haven't done that one.
Oh, it's great. It's great. I will go to the – like, this might be Dolph Lundgren apology tour is the series, because I am an apologist for that Dolph Lundgren Punisher movie.
Let us know what you would prefer. Because we could watch another Mattel movie. I don't think there are that many other Mattel movies. We could watch some kind of Barbie thing, I guess. Let us know what you would like us to do. Tweet at us. I'm the Matt D. Wilson. Chris is the ISB. Go on Tumblr, moviefighterscast.tumblr.com. Let us know there. Thanks. Or just go on our website, which is moviefighterscast.com. Leave us a comment. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another movie, whatever we decide. Our theme is by Michael Kill. Our website was designed by Sean Baugus. See all of you in 2 weeks.
Hey, Matt.
Uh-huh.
Good journey.
Good journey. This has been a Kleitas Media production.